For the week of December 17th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 393, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Allentown, Pennsylvania, I'm Michael Giltz. I'm traveling for the holidays, but by God, I could make myself available for the next 2 weeks' shows, Sperling. I'll do anything for our listeners.
Okay, so you're just trying to point out that I'm traveling over the next 2 weeks and that we can't do shows over the next 2 weeks because of me,
You. That's right. So we will not be having a show. We will not be recording our show on Christmas Day or New Year's Day, which is how it would fall out for us, given the way we usually record on Mondays. So we will be off for the next 2 weeks during the two busiest weeks of the box office of the year. A lot of exciting movies coming out. We'll have to see how Star Wars continues to do. But, you know, hey, everybody deserves a break, even Sperling. So we'll be back like, January 8th or?
I guess, yes.
Yeah. Or 7th, I think, January 7th, the week of January 7th. So 2 weeks off from us. So I know Sperling will be happy to have a break from me. And hopefully you'll miss us and come back. And if you're thinking of a Christmas gift, gee, Sperling, what should they do?
I think that, you know, and this is just me talking. Maybe you want something different, Michael, but they should probably share their favorite podcast, specifically Showbiz Sandbox, or they could go to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, or maybe, you know, I don't know, Stitcher or any one of their favorite podcast aggregators, subscribe and rate and review the show. That would really help us out.
It would be a Festivus miracle.
I'm sure Festivus has something to do with Christmas.
Seinfeld.
Oh, that's true. Yes, you're right.
It would be a Hanukkah miracle, a Christmas miracle, a Festivus miracle, a winter solstice miracle, all rolled up into one. Please take a second, rate and review our show. Get us happy and excited about recording another 50 shows in the new year.
Indeed. In fact, if you want to subscribe to the show, just go to showbizsandbox.com, although you probably have already done that. And that's where you can find ways to contact us and subscribe to the show.
That's right. And if you're listening to the show, even after our begging and pleading, please rate and review us. We'll wait. But while we're waiting, we'll tell you what's going to be on this week's show.
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got a lot to pack in before the holidays. The first award nominations from a guild have arrived, courtesy of the Screen Actors Guild, and the Academy Awards announced their shortlist for the best foreign film. I don't know about you, Michael, but my heart skipped a beat when I heard it. Oh, and speaking of Michael, one of his favorite events of the year took place. The Library of Congress added 25 new works to the National Film Registry, including fiction and documentaries, features and shorts. We'll discuss what significant works they've enshrined, and all I can say about that is yippee-ki-yay, mother...
Whoa. Family show.
Okay, well, all right, fine. Then comes the newest addition to our podcast. We call it the Sexual Conduct Palooza. On Inside Baseball, we look at Disney swallowing up the film and TV units of 21st Century Fox and what it means for the business. I love the way we just put that in one sentence as if it wasn't like the biggest news all week. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also have links to, well, we also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, LA Times, you, our listeners, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, Star Wars The Last Jedi. $450 million on its opening weekend. $40 million of that worldwide came from IMAX. Somebody said about $140 million of it came worldwide from 3D screenings. So just under a third of it came from 3D screenings. I haven't seen any info on what 3D screenings pulled in North America, but still a big player worldwide. But 30% is sure a lot less than 40 or 50 or 60 or 70% like we were seeing a few years ago. So that may be a little hint that 2018 is going to see 3D declining in other territories just like it has in the U.S.
Well, yeah, and with 3D, I think everybody always, at least, you know, distributor-wise, believed 3D is going to be one of those things that kind of declines to a minority portion where it's 20 to 30 to 35%, depending on the movie.
Only on certain movies. It's just for special movies that are shot in 3D like Avatar or shot in IMAX like Dunkirk, and then it will perk up again. Otherwise, it's silly. Don't waste your money. But they thought it was the new world. They thought everything was going to be in 3D. They thought Woody Allen movies were going to be in 3D. That isn't the case. But Star Wars The Last Jedi is a big movie. It was number one almost everywhere in the world except for Turkey, South Korea, India, and Malaysia. We know the film that beat it out in South Korea, but I don't know why it didn't hit the top in Turkey, India, and Malaysia. If you do, contact us.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
Obviously, it was a big, big film. For example, Star Wars The Last Jedi is the second film in history, only the second film in history, to gross more than $100 million in a single day. Star Wars The Force Awakens, of course, was the first. You can read that in countless newspapers and magazines and websites all over the world. It grossed $120 million on its opening Friday.
Hey, you know,
amazing.
I know what you want to point out here. Let me guess. Technically,
it's not true. You know, Star Wars did not gross $120 million on Friday. It grossed $63 million on Friday. In my book, $63 million is not $100 million. It's not even close. Thursday and Friday is not a single day. Sanity must return to reporting on box office. It is ridiculous that everybody in the world said, including the trades, it grossed 100. Then they would, you know, the better ones go, well, of course, you know, 45 million was on Thursday. Well, that's a second day. That's 2 days. It grossed $120 million in 2 days. That's amazing. That's awesome. Champion that. There's no need to exaggerate or distort. It grossed $45 million on Thursday. That ain't $100 million. You know, that is not $100 million. It grossed $64 million on Saturday, $51 million on Sunday. This is a big, big movie, but it did not gross $100 million in a day. No movie ever has. The record is Avengers Age of Ultron, which grossed $65.8 million on a Friday. The second and third are the two Star Wars movies. That's awesome. That's a lot of money. $65 million, and they want to exaggerate it? It's crazy to me. Doesn't it drive you nuts?
Well, yeah, because it's kind of like when the standard aptitude test here in the United States went from 1,600 to 2,200, and, you know, how do you compare the two? It's like, you know what? It's just hard to compare.
Well, we can compare 1 year to the last year. Of course, that's what we do all the time. And 2017 has been trending down compared to 2016. It's a down year, even though, of course, 2016 was the highest grossing year of all time. And 2017 looks good to be the second highest grossing year of all time. Right now, as of this weekend, after Star Wars, we are just $300 million shy of 2016's record gross. So we already, at this stage of the year, we are the second highest grossing year of all time. We'll probably stay that way, depending on how well Star Wars does and Jumanji and the other movies coming out in the next week with a lot of box office to go. We could close that gap, we could pass that gap, or most likely remain in second place. But the second highest grossing year of all time is not cause for concern. All right, back to the box office. The number one movie around the world is, of course, Star Wars The Last Jedi. $450 million worldwide. And number two is Youth. This is a Chinese period drama set in the 70s about young people in a military cultural troupe. It was approved by the censors. It was about to be released, and then they yanked it. It might have been because it was during the Party Congress. It might have been because they needed to re-edit some scenes and they felt like some stuff was a little touchy because there are some cynical people in the movie and some things that you could misconstrue or construe as not wildly positive about, you know, the cultural troop program, I guess. I don't know. But in any case, they pulled it. It disappeared. Now it came out in another big period for box office. And it grossed $44 million on the weekend. I guess it came out on a Wednesday because its total is $48 million in China and presumably Hong Kong and a few other small territories. So for a movie that costs $18 million, that is a huge hit. I mean, right off the bat, it's pretty much in the black.
Well, and think about it. $44 million. That puts it in second place. I mean, it's only 10% worldwide, and it's only 10% of what Star Wars made. But think about, you know, think about what you have. You have a juggernaut of Star Wars, but $44 million in any other week, most other weeks, it would be number one.
Well, no, I don't know about that. A lot of movies open bigger worldwide, especially we have a lot of movies that open. But that would get you at number one a lot of weeks in North America for sure.
That's what I'm saying. So, yeah.
Well, sure. But yeah, it's a big hit. And what matters is how much it costs and how much it grossed. And in that, by that standard, it's already a smash success. And number three is another movie doing really well in the Middle Kingdom. It's Coco. Disney's Pixar animated film grossed $37 million on the weekend. I know some Oscar voters who just watched it last night and they loved it. They were happy about it. They thought it was great. So it's going to get their vote, I imagine. $37 million on the weekend, $450 million worldwide. And it still has like a third of the world to go. That will happen early next year.
You know, everybody who looks at animated films and casts votes for animated films, the people I speak with, they've watched all of them and they're really hoping that the breadwinner, that people see the breadwinner because they think it's, you know, yes, Coco, but the breadwinner might be, at least from its themes, you know, it's in Afghanistan and its story takes place about a girl who has to become the breadwinner for her family in Afghanistan, that, you know, it should be best animated feature Oscar worthy. And
because of what it is or because it's really good?
Both.
Okay, because I don't care about what topics it tackles. If it's the best film, it should be the winner. If it's the best film and it's silly, I don't care.
But of course, people have to see it.
Yes, they do have to see it. And all Oscar voters will get a copy of it in their mailbox. They probably have it now. They won't get a copy of this next movie yet. It's The Thousand Faces of Dunjia. I'm sure I'm butchering that. It's directed by the guy, Wo Ping, who did the action scenes in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And it's produced and written by Hark, who is one of the great names in these fantasy martial arts movies, this entire genre. It's in fact a remake of 1982's The Miracle Fighters. It's about people with supernatural powers who have to defend the earth from outside evil. It grossed $27 million on the weekend. It's at $34 million worldwide. I'm not sure how much the budget is. If you know, let us know. But it's a solid opening for a movie that looks elaborate and expensive. But how much that means in Chinese terms, I don't know. And number five is Ferdinand, the only film brave enough to open opposite Star Wars here in North America. It's the animated tale about the bull who doesn't want to fight. John Cena provides the voice. I love the picture book as a kid. It grossed $19 million on its opening weekend, and they hope and expect it will have a really good multiple, really good legs, just like Alvin and the Chipmunks a few years ago. They think this one, families with smaller kids will want to turn to this movie over the next 15 days from Christmas to New Year.
You know, Jim Amos over at Celluloid Junkie said the same thing, that it would, you know, it would be the one film, sure, everybody went to see Star Wars this weekend, but next week they'll need something to take the kids to, and Ferdinand will probably be it, because Coco they've probably already seen. But I loved what he said. He said, audience didn't seem to run with Ferdinand.
At number six is another family-friendly movie. It's Wonder, $14 million on the weekend, $150 million worldwide. Your mom will want to go see Murder on the Orient Express. That's just about to hit $300 million worldwide. That's now six times its budget, practically. So that movie is a monster. It cost $55 million to make. I assume the sequel will cost more, as all the big celebrities go, hey, you made a lot of money on that last one, didn't you?
Yeah.
And number eight is the number one film in South Korea. It's Steel Rain, a thriller written and directed by Yang Wo-suk. And it's based on his webtoon of the same name. It's the story of a North Korean and a South Korean government agents who team up to prevent nuclear war. And it grossed $11 million on its opening weekend. And it's the movie that kept Star Wars from being number one in that country. And number nine is Paddington 2. That's edging up towards $100 million worldwide. And number 10 is Daddy's Home 2, $150 million worldwide. Justice League, slowly fading away a bit. I don't think it has any other big territories to go. It's grossed $630 million worldwide, and it's starting to really slow down. Just below that is Thor Ragnarok, which is at $840 million worldwide. You know, you make an extra $200 million, and everyone will call you a success. And number 13 is The Disaster Artist. I like James Franco. He's having a nutty career, but I like that he does all these sort of crazy, wacky things, and sometimes they work. This movie has grossed $15 million so far here in North America. I think it's in a few other territories, but basically North America. And it's not doing well. I mean, it broke through. People saw it, and I think they just didn't like it. It dropped pretty hard this weekend. I don't think the word of mouth has been very good, and I think it'll probably disappear quickly, but good on him for trying.
Critics loved it.
Well, I don't know about loved it. Some liked it, yes. I'm also seeing iffy stuff for The Shape of Water. That expanded a bit. It grossed $1.7 million on the weekend. It's still got a pretty solid box office per screen average. It's at $3.6 million total, but I'm still convinced that it will not be a commercial movie, and that it only cost $20 million to make, but I don't know if it's going to get to $60 million worldwide, and I don't think it's going to play well for audiences in North America. You never know. And it is getting some end-of-the-year attention, so that should give it legs.
Wait a second.
Oh, fins? legs? Where you're gonna make a vote?
Yeah, that's where I was headed with that.
But yeah, we'll see. It's hard. You know, when you talk about end of the year and the Oscars and the SAG Awards and what movies should win and will win, the biggest problem you can have is actually seeing the movie. Because once I see The Shape of Water and I really don't like it and don't think it's a good movie, it's hard for me to see it as an end of the year hopeful. It's not a movie that I thought was good, and I didn't think it would play well commercially because it had sort of a dark, dark, sort of unpleasant finale. So, you know, that doesn't help. Don't see the movies and you'll probably do a better job of guessing the Oscars than if you do.
Well, that's probably how most people vote for them.
Certainly the Beatles are. Way down at the bottom, there's one movie I want to mention. It's Wonder Wheel, the Woody Allen movie. We were talking before the show opened. It grossed $1.2 million on the weekend. It's at $2.3 million total. It's looking like it'll be one of the Woody Allen movies that doesn't quite click. And I thought, gee, you know, he's been getting big budgets in these last few years, and I wondered how he was doing. And frankly, this movie aside, he's really been at sort of a peak level of commercial popularity in the last 10, 12 years, as big as he's been since the early 70s. I mean, this is 40 years later. He had Blue Jasmine grossed $100 million worldwide. Vicky Cristina Barcelona grossed $100 million. Match Point grossed, one of those grossed $160. Where is that? Midnight in Paris grossed $160 million. Match Point, $87 million. To Rome with Love, $75 million. Before Match Point in 2005, only one movie in Woody Allen's entire history had grossed $40 million, and that was Hannah and Her Sisters. But of course, Sperling would say you got to adjust for inflation, and he's right. Manhattan, adjusted for inflation, would be a $130 million film. Annie Hall would have grossed $150 million. So yeah, most of his movies throughout his career grossed $10 million or less. Just a few gross $18 million. He had a level of commercial popularity in the 70s, late 70s, right up into Hannah and Her Sisters. But then 30 years later, he's doing it again. I mean, these are big hits. You know, he's making movies for $25, $30 million, and they're grossing $160, $100, $190. So Woody Allen, despite his personal travails, is really as big as he's been in his entire career. It doesn't feel like that, but it's true.
Well, and then you have Cafe Society, which in 2016, just last year, it cost an estimated $30 million to make and grossed worldwide $34 million. Theatrically, of course, it's now on Amazon.
Right. He had lots of flops for most of his career. I mean, there were lots of movies that didn't score big. That movie, Cafe Society, is probably a good example of a movie that they're not going to make. Certainly, it's not a hit in terms of just box office, but given his name value and the stars attached, they'll probably eke out some profits, you know, 10, 20 years down the road, right? It's not going to cost them their shirt. You know, they're making movies for under $30 million. Sometimes they click big and you make $160 million. Sometimes they don't and you, you know, barely get your budget back. But he's been a pretty good bet in the last 10, 15 years, and I hadn't thought about that, and it's true. And he's certainly not a good bet for the SAG Awards because he's not even mentioned in there, I don't think. I don't think Kate Winslet.
Yes.
And she gives a fine performance. She's the best thing in the movie. But she didn't get a SAG award. And we really care about the SAG awards, don't we? Because they're actually voted on by some people who will vote on the Oscars.
Yeah, I mean, a large majority of the Academy voters are actually actors. That's one of their biggest branches.
Mm-hmm. So you'll be happy because their equivalent to Best Picture actually captures some of the movies you really liked this year, didn't they?
Yes, so we have Outstanding Performance by a Cast. So that's their version of Best Picture, the SAG, you know, awards version of Best Picture. And The Big Sick, finally, The Big Sick getting a little love. Get Out, Lady Bird, Mudbound, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. You want to talk about a title, let's just shorten it to Three Billboards for Pete's sake.
Right, so this is where we start to get a sense of what movies have actual momentum, because these are some of the people who will be voting for the Oscars. The SAG actually contains a lot more actors with TV and stuff other than people who are in the Academy. So it's a much bigger group of people. So it's not a clear link, but it's certainly the first good indication by people who will actually place ballots. It's the first one that matters. And so you see things like Judi Dench in the forgettable Victorian Abdul, but it's the twilight of her career, and she got an Oscar nomination. Daniel Day-Lewis, who is in the twilight of his career and insists he has retired, of course, until he unretires and makes another movie, but he retired. Is he mentioned for Best Actor? No, he's not. Is that telling? I don't know. Willem Dafoe, everybody seems to like him in The Florida Project, so he got a nomination. So it's a thing you can tea leave, read, see what's going on, start to get a sense of some movies that actually might have Oscar momentum.
Yeah, I think this might be Willem Dafoe's year. Has he won an Oscar already? Maybe for Platoon?
I don't believe he has, but we'll have to check. But I do know that Oscar has announced the 9 films that are shortlisted for the best foreign film, which they really should change to the best international film, I think.
Well, I guess because technically, I mean, what would you call it, actually? International language film?
Best international film, best international language, or foreign language film, I guess would be more accurate, but it's not foreign to the people who speak it. Hey, I would just say best international film. Everybody knows the Oscars is centered in Hollywood. Best international film. They would get it. I think it was CNN who said, hey, we're not going to say foreign. We're going to say international. And I thought, oh, that's a good point. Willem Dafoe has been nominated for an Academy Award twice, once in Platoon and once for Shadow of the Vampire, where he played Max Schreck, the actor. He has never won.
I actually worked on Shadow of the Vampire.
It's a fun little movie. I like the book.
I never thought that film would work.
No, it did work. It wasn't a successful movie. It was nice of him to get a nomination. I appreciated his work. I liked the book better. I think it was by Jim Shepard.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting project. But it is sort of sad. The movies that are up for international film Oscar shortlist, France is off the list. Beats Per Minute, one of the best films of the year, nominated or acknowledged by a lot of critic groups, didn't even make the cut.
Yeah, I was a little surprised by that, especially given its subject matter. And I know, Michael, that you don't like it when, you know, people are looking at these awards films just for the subject matter and not necessarily in total. But I was a little surprised that the subject matter didn't put it over the top.
Absolutely. But, you know, Israel Foxtrot, I've heard a lot of good things about that. Of course, The Square was a hit at Cannes.
It won the Palme d'Or.
And Loveless from our favorite Russian director of the moment, Andrei Zvyagintsev. Thank you. So there's a couple interesting movies that we anticipate will be shortlisted. Chile has A Fantastic Woman, which I've heard is quite a good lead performance and is about a trans person. So perhaps that will be on the shortlist as much for its subject matter as for the quality of the film, which I've heard is pretty good. But we'll have to wait and see.
And another Cannes film from Germany, In the Fade.
Yes, the Fatih Akin. He's a great director. I haven't heard this is one of his better films. I've heard it's, you know, a bit of a miss, but I certainly like him a lot.
Well, you know, there's one thing that's certain. I don't think any of these movies will ever be put in the National Film Registry because they are all made outside the United States. And the National Film Registry, which is put together by the Library of Congress, takes American-made movies, and every year they pick about, I think it's 25 films that they put in their registry as kind of being culturally and artistically significant.
Not both necessarily.
Yeah, no. It could be, one could be culturally, one could be aesthetically, one could be artistically. Yeah, I mean.
Right. So, which explains why on this list of 25 films, which I love every year, you have stuff like The Goonies and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner is, of course, about interracial marriage. It stars Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, and Sidney Poitier. It's a dreadful movie, well-intentioned at the time. There's a lovely speech by Spencer Tracy at the end. It's the only reason to watch the film. He talks. Katharine Hepburn listens with tears in her eyes. It's heart-tugging. It's lovely. But the movie itself is a bore. Goonies. I have no idea why Goonies is an important film. I know it is. I know it is a touchstone for an entire generation. It's a dreadful movie. But God, it was on cable or VHS and kids loved it and they won't stop thinking about it. And it belongs here in the sense that it really is a landmark film that you can see its influence on Stranger Things. And I mean, it is just a touchstone for an entire generation.
Yeah, and Die Hard, okay, talk about a touchstone for an entire generation. This was kind of indicative of the action films of the 1980s.
Right, and very influential. You had Die Hard on a bus, like Speed, and I mean, it was pitched forever, Die Hard on a plane, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it, of course, harkens back to Stagecoach, John Wayne's breakthrough of that sort of iconic film where you have a group of people under stress, trapped in a thing. You've got the coward, you've got the villain, you've got the hero. You know, it's part of that Hollywood history, and it has also spun off a sort of distinctive genre. Again, it's actually a fun film, unlike Goonies and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. It's actually a good movie, not a great movie, but it's good. And it's you can see why it's there. Then you have the actual films that maybe are great, like Ace in the Hole.
Oh, such a good movie. Billy Wilder directing.
Yes, it's my favorite Billy Wilder film. It's just a corrosive film about journalism. I just love it.
Oh, that's true, actually. That is actually true.
Yeah. And there's films that you probably haven't heard of, but you can check out, like a documentary called Boulevard Nights about Chicano youth in L.A. Actually, I don't know if it is a documentary or a fictional film. But there's Gentleman's Agreement, another film that's not actually good, though it was important at the time. It's also Billy Wilder, isn't it?
I believe so.
Yeah, and it's about anti-Semitism. No, Gentleman's Agreement. I'm thinking of the drinking movie. Gentleman's Agreement is not Billy Wilder.
The Lost Weekend,
Yeah, I was thinking of The Lost Weekend. Gentleman's Agreement is about anti-Semitism, where Gregory Peck, in an expose, goes from hotel to restaurant, and he says, "I'd like to book a room." And they said, "Yeah, of course, sir." He says, "Would it matter if I were a Jew?" And they say, "Oh, I'm sorry, we're booked up." You know, so it's just a very, very heavy-handed movie. But you know, God bless you. It's Elia Kazan directed it, and Gregory Peck is in it, and it was very important at the time. But yeah, I love the list. It's great. We've got links to some of the more obscure stuff that are on YouTube already. There's home movies from a family living on the U.S.-Mexican border, the Fuentes Family Home Movie Collection. We've got a link to the Texas Archives. The interior of the New York City subway from 14th Street to 42nd Street. I watched all 8 minutes. That's on YouTube. The Sinking of the Lusitania. I love this. It's a short by Winsor McKay, a great cartoonist who created Little Nemo in Slumberland, one of the great comic strip panels that appeared in newspapers, and he ventured into animation and stuff, and he did this docu animated thing which combined newspaper headlines and some photos and documentary animation showing what it would have looked like if you were watching the Lusitania sink. It was a really rabble-rousing, trying to get people ginned up for the war. It ended up not airing or being seen until after the U.S. had entered the war, but nonetheless they were still trying to, you know, rile people up. And there's a footage from the Spanish Civil War called "With the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in the Spanish Civil War." We have a link to that as well. So there's lots of cool stuff. Great films like To Sleep with Anger, and Thelonious Monk, Straight No Chaser.
That is one Superman. Of my favorite jazz document. That movie is really good.
Yeah, it's terrific. And have you ever seen Jazz on a Summer's Day?
I have not. I will definitely.
That's my favorite jazz concert of all time. Awesome movie. And Superman from 1978, to me, still the greatest superhero film of all time. That's on the list. And then Titanic, Spartacus, Only Angels Have Wings. That's a fun movie. Memento, La Bamba. You can see why they're here. It's fun stuff.
Well,
check it out.
Well, with Memento, of course, we're talking about that disjointed narrative. That was between that and Pulp Fiction. Those two films kind of helped usher in that era of, you know, you don't have to tell a story linearly.
Oh, they brought it back into fashion, perhaps.
Yes, correct. Yes.
And if you want to watch your dad cry, just screen Field of Dreams.
Well, if you build it, they will come, actually.
They will cry. And Spike Lee's greatest film, Four Little Girls, a marvelous documentary. Talk about heart-tugging. Really piercing. He's made a number of good films, great films, but I think that's his best. And that is something where you get clouded by the subject matter, but he did the subject matter justice. And that's why I think it's a great film, not because it's about the bombing in Alabama, but because he did it so well.
Well, I've got to tell you that if you're Kirk Douglas, you've got to be very happy because you got two films in this selection.
He got Ace in the Hole. What's the other film?
I am Spartacus.
You are Spartacus. That's right. We are all Spartacus.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was a good week for Kirk. He's 101. He's still alive. And he's got two new movies on the National Film Registry.
Well, and he's not a part of the list that we're about to talk about.
That's right. It's the time for Sexual Misconduct Palooza. Are we making light of it? No.
No, not at all. It's just become so prevalent.
A regular feature.
Yes, unfortunately. And nobody will be more happy than myself when we can move past this, not only because there aren't new allegations being made, but as a society, we've moved past it, meaning people start behaving better.
Well, that would be good, but I think that's a decade-long process, so it's not going to end anytime soon.
Well, I would agree with that. I think it's, you know, look, it's humanity, basically.
So we've got an article in the to talk about this issue. We had an article in the LA Times from one of the women who came forward about Dustin Hoffman, and she talked about her experience suddenly becoming a clearinghouse for journalists, how people would contact her, and she would try and convince them to speak to reporters and go on the record, and how that all works. And she was trying to make the point that if you think all these stories are just flooding out and they're just printing anything and everything, believe me, good journalists, good outlets, and a lot of the stuff that has mattered has come from the New York Times, the New Yorker, Variety, the Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times. It's not coming from, you know, a tweet.
Correct.
That somebody randomly tosses out. That they are doing their work to make sure that they have legitimate people, they can verify what they can and believe their story has believability, you know, ideally if somebody else they told the story to at the time. That provides a certain measure of context. So she just sort of detailing the process that's been going on ever since she first came out and said this happened to her. I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, and there were three bullet points that I would point out. The first one was most victims don't want to talk about their humiliating experiences, even off the record, and that building a story requires trust, a trust between a journalist and the subject. And I have to say, Jodi Kantor and her co-writer there, the ones who broke the...
In the New York Times.
Harvey Weinstein. They talk about on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. If you can get a hold of that interview, and it's online, you just search for Fresh Air and Jodi Kantor. They talk about the months of building trust with these subjects and going and visiting them and spending time with them and how much time it took for the subjects to actually... To actually trust them. And it was Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey are the authors.
Well, you think celebrities' lives are an open book, and they're not all celebrities that have come forward, but of course their lives, you think you know everything, but you don't. And you have to realize, hey, you know, do you really, how embarrassing and difficult it is to have your husband, your children, your friends, your coworkers read these painful, difficult details. You know, so you can understand why it would be hard to do. But it continues. And we've got a new round of allegations and news stories about people. Ken Friedman is a power restaurateur, and he faces widespread sexual misconduct charges. The usual array of groping, forcible kissing, women quitting but afraid to speak out because he talked about blackballing and they saw it happen. So he faces a serious number of allegations from a number of people. Tavis Smiley, on the other hand, is a major figure in journalism. He has a show on PBS. His show has been suspended, and PBS says they have done an investigation and that they have concerns. He adamantly denies any misconduct and says, from point of view, like they were investigating him and he didn't find out about it until third hand. And once he found out about it, they spoke to him, and then immediately it was printed in Variety before they had any ability to act on what he said. He says, quote, "I have the utmost respect for women and celebrate the courage of those who have come forth to tell their truth." This is what he said on Facebook. "To be clear, I have never groped, coerced, or exposed myself inappropriately to any workplace colleague in my entire broadcast career covering six networks over 30 years. Never, ever, never." So that is as adamant and clear, not a, oh, I don't remember doing that, or well, maybe I did it, but I feel bad about it, or it was consensual. That is a blanket, strong statement from Tavis Smiley. We'll have to see what ends up. PBS says they looked into it, and they have multiple credible allegations that they're concerned about. He says, quote, "If having a consensual relationship with a colleague years ago is the stuff that leads to this kind of public humiliation and personal destruction, heaven help us," end quote. So that's why, you know, we always try to like, hey, we're reporting on it. Doesn't mean they're guilty. Doesn't mean they're innocent. You always want to, you know, take a step back, catch your breath, not allow a witch hunt type atmosphere. For a lot of people, like the restaurateur, you've got a number of women coming forward publicly and being reported on by journalists. That concerns you. In this case, we've got just an investigation by PBS. We don't have anybody coming forward. We don't know what the details are. So, hey, you know, hold off before you condemn them.
And then there are people like Morgan Spurlock. And full disclosure, I do know Morgan Spurlock. I did go to school with him. He comes out and says, look, before anybody says anything, I am part of the problem. And he kind of came out.
Twitter post, didn't he, about this?
Yeah. And, you know, he said, you know, I realized in thinking about it that, you know, there was an episode in college where, you know, I thought I was having a consensual relationship or a consensual experience with a girl. And she later wrote a short story about it for her college class. And she described it as rape. And I didn't know that she felt that way. He said that he settled a case against a coworker or one of his employees.
Or an employee.
Where he called her, I think, hot pants or sex pants or something like that.
Well, that's how he describes it, yes.
Yeah, and he said...
I don't feel comfortable with that description, but anyway.
Yeah, and he
it's
said...
It's like, you paid somebody money because you said hot pants? That seems a bit much.
No, so he went on to say what was wrong about that is that, you know, I was doing it simply because I wanted to stay who I was. I knew that she could, you know, go out there and say this stuff. And I thought, you know what? It was wrong of me to say it in the first place. Fine. I'll come to a settlement with you.
He also says he's cheated on every wife and girlfriend he's ever had. And he has harassed people. He says, quote, I'm part of the problem. And he stepped down from his company. A sequel to Super Size Me was going to debut at Sundance. His company has voluntarily pulled it. One doesn't know whether he just had a change of heart or conscience and wants to be a better person, or whether he was just trying to beat to the punch some allegation that was about to come public. Perhaps it's a combination of the two, but, you know, you don't want to pat him on the back and say, good for you for saying you were a pig. You know, you don't want to go overboard congratulating someone and saying, I've done terrible things. But, you know, I hope more people who have done it also come forward. So, you know, it's the right thing to do.
Well, I don't think Russell Simmons was coming forward, not with the allegations against him. And he is the record producer.
Oh, my God. Yes. And he's, you know, a wonderfully important figure in music and the Black community and positive charities and positive community outreach and people helping people get jobs and educate. You know, he's just been such a good figure. It's really heartbreaking. It was so awful. I think it was on Friday where new allegations came out. And there was an article from Variety or The Hollywood Reporter, and it said the headline in the email said three more women come forward. And I click on it. And when it gets to the article, it was like an hour later. It wasn't what the time I got the email. It said four more women. The headline had changed to four more women. So like, oh, my God, dear God. So an hour or two later, I saw there was an article, an email from Variety, the other one, or Hollywood Report. And it said, you know, three more women had come forward. I click on it and it said eight more women. Eight. Oh, my God. You're like every hour. Like if I don't check on the email right away, the news keeps changing. So that is distressing and heartrending, that whole situation. At ESPN, one of the top people at ESPN has stepped down. It's John Skipper, and he has resigned, and he cites substance addiction, and perhaps that's the end of it. But there have been recent articles talking about the locker room culture at the network, and that certainly didn't help him.
Wait. You're talking about a locker room culture at a sports network? I'm shocked.
Let's not make fun of it. Sexual harassment and assault. Not funny. But no, I get it. It's a good joke. The Guardian had a story detailing widespread sexual misconduct in Bollywood. We report on Bollywood a lot. We love it. We support it. And they talk to many women and some men about harassment, assault, and trading of sexual favors for roles. It's widespread. It's long term. It's going to take a lot of change, a lot of people coming forward before that changes. So it was good to see attention being shed on that. A former wardrobe stylist, speaking of locker room behavior, has filed suit against NFL Enterprises. She worked as a wardrobe stylist for the NFL Network, which is a cable channel, just like the Major League Baseball Network. And she says three on-air analysts have been suspended during the investigation into her allegations. She has filed a suit against them, and she alleges multiple sexual misconduct. She complained and said she was told, quote, it's part of the job when you look the way you do, end quote.
That right there is sexual harassment. If you're looking for, you know, textbook example, that's it.
Now, I don't know Good Day LA, and I don't know the Emmy-winning local anchor Steve Edwards.
Yeah, he's been around for forever. He's like 30 years in the business. And, you know, Good Day LA, it was a local channel here in Los Angeles. You know, it was, you know, a KTLA, I think it was. And it's like their version of the Today Show, you know, the morning show.
And it's not clear. I mean, he was near the end of a contract. He's probably near the end of his career. And it wasn't clear if something came up and they decided it was easier just to fire him or let him go than to actually do an investigation and either clear or condemn him based on what they found. So it's a little murky there, but he's been let go by the show. And unfortunately, it's under a cloud, unfortunately, if it's not true.
Yes, correct.
Right. And Netflix did fire the executive, speaking of bad things to say to employees. They fired an exec who told one of the alleged assault victims of Danny Masterson that we don't believe them. We don't believe those accusations of rape. Not a smart thing to do. And they lost their job. Mario Batali has been officially fired from The Chew. ABC yanked a TV show called The American Bake Off because of sexual misconduct allegations against one of their hosts. A Hong Kong associate of Harvey Weinstein is accused of sexual misconduct by multiple women. One of the producers behind The Florida Project, one of my favorite films of the year and featuring some great women in great roles, he's been accused of sexual misconduct. Paul Haggis, the director, is being sued by a woman who accuses him of rape, a publicist. He countersued before she formally filed suit. He adamantly denies it and calls it a shakedown for $9 million. The showrunner of NCIS New Orleans has been investigated twice by the network for misconduct, but they did nothing, and now they face new allegations of this person's sexual misconduct, harassment, racially charged statements, prejudice against women, especially working mothers, and on and on and on. And here's sort of, you know, these things matter, and you talk about how the careers get affected. I remember Mira Sorvino winning an Oscar and then falling off the map, and you can never know what didn't happen. Like, Did I not get a role? Did something not happen? Was somebody poisoning people against me? And you just don't know whether they just made bad choices, or they weren't striking while the iron was hot, or they had other priorities like having children or something. I don't know. But you do notice sometimes people sort of just having that moment and then disappearing and not making the most of it. And now Peter Jackson, the director, has come forward and says when he was casting The Lord of the Rings and thinking about people like Mira Sorvino and Ashley Judd, they would have been on the short list of women, young, talented female actors that you might think about for certain roles. He said the Weinstein Company told him, oh, they're a nightmare to work with. You don't want to work with them.
Well, the Weinstein Company wasn't around at that time.
Well, sorry, Miramax.
Yeah, okay.
Who actually was making the movie happen.
Right.
And then they sold it off to New Line Cinema because they sold off basically all of it to New Line Cinema. But I beg your pardon. It's Miramax. The people there at Miramax said, oh, yeah, you know, they're a nightmare to work with. You don't want to work with them. And he's like, oh, okay. And he believed. Why would they say that if it wasn't true? They must be a nightmare to work with. And Mira Sorvino, I think, tweeted or made a statement and said, you know, she actually cried when she read that, when Peter Jackson said that. Thinking about all, you know, she always felt like she was blackballed. And it was a relief to know she wasn't just imagining it. But it was sad to know what possibilities in career and things she might have done or had if that hadn't happened, you know. So it's an ugly, messy thing, but some people are trying to take some positive steps. CAA is skipping their Golden Globes bash, and instead they're going to donate money to a legal defense fund for sexual harassment. Forget the parties.
Yeah, well, if you read Richard Lovett's long, it was a long, long email, but worth reading.
Uh-huh. And the Hollywood community, the Hollywood studios, have unveiled a commission on sexual harassment and equality in the workplace, and they're not messing around. It's going to be led by Anita Hill. They had their first meeting. 24 top industry officials, men and women, came together. They convened the group. Anita Hill is in charge, and now they're going to start meeting regularly and look towards developing some best practices and things they can do to suggest changes in the industry to improve the workplace environment for everyone.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what they, you know, some of their first publications and what they first do.
Exactly. And Rupert Murdoch proved he's an old man by making asinine comments about sexual misconduct. He was giving an interview talking about Disney buying out most of 20th Century Fox assets, mainly the film and TV studio. And he said, all this stuff, it's, quote, probably a bit of flirting. You know, that's all it amounts to. It's just a bit of flirting. Blown out of proportion.
If there was one person on earth that I would say probably shouldn't talk about this right now, it would be Rupert Murdoch, given that he owns the Fox News Network.
And he wants this deal to go through.
Yeah.
But that will come in Inside Baseball. But first, we have Big Deal, Big Whip, don't we?
Yes, indeed. It is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, could have been a segment unto itself. Amidst security threats, protests, and the specter of lawsuits, the FCC repealed net neutrality rules on a 3-2 partisan vote, as expected, ushering in an era where big pocket companies will have to pay a fee to get on the fast lanes provided for them by internet service providers, ISPs as they are known, or they'll see their websites slow to a crawl. Consumers will inevitably pay more as well in both fees and the fact that new small businesses will be hamstrung from the start. Less competition means less innovation and higher prices. The entertainment business will be particularly affected since everyone from major studios to indie musicians use the internet to sell and stream their products to consumers. I'm not even going to ask, is this a big deal or a big whoop? Because you and I both know, Michael, it's a big deal.
It absolutely is, and it doesn't have to stand. You just can't depend on the FCC to do it. If you think it's important, you need to support people who will change the laws permanently in the House and the Senate, and that means voting for the Democrats, since the Republicans basically think net neutrality is a joke and pointless, even though it's great for the economy, great for every business except the 2 or 3 ISPs that will make more money off of it.
This is such a blatant grab for telcos, okay? It's just remarkable to me that this could go through and they could, no, this is good. This is good. And they kind of couch it, agitpie. I mean, this guy, he is the Tom Wheeler everybody thought he was. Like, you know, everybody kind of like lionized, or not lionized, but they kind of bashed Tom Wheeler because they thought, oh, he's just a telco mouthpiece. You know, he's just there to do the bidding of the telcos. Well, indeed, actually, it was agitpie. And he did this right-wing video, you know, that I thought was really poor judgment. We talked about it before we began recording, that you said, well, you know, he's just kind of, he's doing the bidding of the Trump administration, but it was paid for by right-wing conservative website. And he was once a lawyer for Verizon. And guess where he's going to go after he leaves his chairmanship at the FCC? Where do you think he's going to work?
Has he announced?
No, but probably like where Michael Powell, the former head of the FCC, now is the head of the National Cable and Telecommunications Administration or Association. Right. William Kennard, he sits on the board of AT&T and several other boards, but they all wind up back in that industry. And
right. So it's a revolving door, just like the defense industry and so many others in Washington.
Right. And, you know, here's the deal. Pi wants there to be a free market. Okay. And okay, fine. Let there be a free market. However, as the FCC itself reports, over 50% of the homes in the United States using the internet have only one choice of internet service provider. So if you don't want to pay for faster service, you can go to another. Oh, you can't, actually. And so there's been this express mail analogy where if somebody wants to deliver something to you via express mail, meaning a faster lane on the internet, they have to pay a little extra, right? So if Netflix wants to get their content to you or Disney wants to get their content to you a little faster and when they want to be prioritized to get to you on your television set, they'll pay a little extra. However, there's a problem with that analogy, and that is this. Do you pay for a mailbox? Okay, Michael, you do pay for a mailbox because you actually have a... Do you still have a post office box?
No, I don't.
Oh, so actually you don't pay for a mailbox. So right now, the people who would be charging for that fast lane are charging twice. They're charging the customer to receive the actual data, and they're charging the people trying to deliver the data. So it would be like Amazon paying to deliver a package to you, and then when that package arrives, you pay the delivery service for the same service.
And of course, a free market is a canard. The choice is not a free market, unregulated, or, you know, lots of silly, stupid rules that just hinder a free market. There are always rules. The question is, who do they benefit? Do they benefit just one or two big companies, or do they benefit most businesses and most people in the country? And that's what a net neutrality does. And more importantly, the internet is a utility. It's as essential to our national security and our business and a free society as water and electricity and, you know, that stuff. And it should be regulated the same way. And the only way that's going to change is if you put people in power in the House, the Senate, and the White House who want that to happen.
Now, if you really want to learn some interesting information about this whole argument, I would read Tim Wu's piece in Wired magazine. I'll place a link to it in our show notes. It's called How the FCC's Net Neutrality Plan Breaks with 50 Years of History. By the way, Tim Wu is a technology historian and an expert. He's the one who coined the phrase net neutrality, number one. And if you're wondering how, you know, if you're outside the US, how does this relate to me? Here's how. Because Netflix is such a, and Amazon, because they're such big users of data, they're pushing so much data, all of these companies, okay, all, like the Comcast, the Spectrum cables, all the telcos are going to turn to Netflix. They're going to turn to Amazon and they're going to say, we want more money from you for interconnects. Okay. You're sending us more data than we're sending you. We want more money. So of course, what will happen is not that Comcast and the cable providers and the ISPs will begin to charge more to their subscribers, because of course that would be very blatant. Okay. That would be, people would catch on to that really quickly. Instead, what they'll do is they'll charge all the people trying to deliver to their subscribers more, which in turn costs more for those companies to operate, which in turn will actually wind up costing consumers more, because Netflix and Amazon, they will have to raise their subscription prices. And once they do that in the United States, guess what's going to happen elsewhere?
Tell me.
They're going to raise, you know, look, if they can get away with charging $15 per month or $16 or $20 per month, then all of a sudden, you'll start to see something go to maybe 18 euros instead of 9 or 10 euros. Or in Australia, maybe it'll be a little bit more expensive because they'll see that they got away with it in the US. That's how it affects the rest of the world.
Exactly. Well, let's move on. It's a terrible thing, but we ain't going to fix it today.
No. Now, new PR firms are popping up like mushrooms after a fall rain. The latest example, four staffers from the top PR firms ID and 42 West have left to form their own company dubbed Narrative. Their names won't be familiar to the public, but their clients most certainly are. They rep top talent like Jennifer Lawrence, Amy Adams, and Daisy Ridley, just to name a few. They made the usual polite noises about appreciating their mentors and the chance to learn the business, but of course, at the same time, they're busy taking as many clients with them as possible. This comes in the wake of two or three new PR firms specializing in theater in just the past year. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I guess it's a big whoop. I thought it was kind of a big deal, and I felt like, wow, there's a lot of new PR firms popping up, especially because of the ones that happened in the theater. Suddenly they're like, every couple months, somebody was leaving one firm to start a new one. And I kept thinking, do they think there's that much business available? What's going on? How can there be that much demand? How can they launch a business? And I was imagining maybe it's just the tools are so widely available with MailChimp and able to send out email lists. I also thought maybe artists need a lot more attention now, because it used to be you had a big movie star, they had a movie, you had that period where you promoted it, and then they were off the radar for a while. Then you geared up again for the next project. Now it's just 24/7 news cycle. They've got social media, they've got movies, and they've got a TV show, and they've maybe got a video posting online and a product launch and a social media presence year round. I was imagining maybe celebs just need a lot more intensive care than they did in the old days. You know, even the smaller ones, they've got a lot going on. So maybe there's just more work to go around. But the people I talked to in the PR industry were like, nah, this always happened. People always break away and start their own firms. Nothing new.
Yeah, so it isn't take them anything at their new. Work. You know, certainly you had Huvane Baum Halls, right? The names of the three founders of the agency. PMK, right? The name of the founder, you know, the initial, everybody just does initials, I guess. Now they actually have names. But ID and 42West are big, big firms, okay? But then it's like I said, it's cyclical. So you have all of these people break away who worked at big firms. Rogers and Cowan was one of them at a time. It still is a big firm. And people broke away and they started HBH and PMK. And then all of those companies that were you know, separated, they all started to come together again and form these bigger companies. And then people at those companies kind of left and started their own companies. 42 West was started that way. So it's just a cycle.
There you go. All right. Up next. First, Barry Diller wanted to float an island in New York's harbor for private parties. I mean, as a gift to the city. Now, in L.A., he's tossed out the idea of a gondola ride to the Hollywood sign. Huh? Well, as locals know, tourists are constantly driving into people's neighborhoods to get a close-up look at the sign and maybe grab a photo. It's a constant complaint. Diller's idea is to set up a gondola ride from the parking lot of the LA Zoo to Mount Lee for a close-up look at the sign. There even be a visitor center or something there. His wife, Diane von Furstenberg, and yes, he's gay, but they're married and best friends, so don't judge. She sees the gondola as sort of an LA equivalent to New York's High Line. It is just an idea, but Diller is offering $30 million to make it happen. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? And I'm reading this because it's your town.
Well, okay, so I used to live on Beechwood Canyon Drive, okay, and this is the street, the only street that leads up to the Hollywood sign, and it's, you know, it's up in the Hollywood Hills, and the streets are very, very narrow as you get closer to the sign, and very twisted, and it's easy to get into an accident there. They're one-lane roads, and it has become more and more problematic over the years. I mean, when I first moved to Los Angeles, yeah, I mean, there was some traffic, but not a lot. I mean, it wasn't like people were trying to drive up to the sign. But now it's like, you know, rush hour. And the residents are complaining. A gondola ride? I don't know about that. What they're saying is they would like to take it from the LA Zoo, which is almost behind the Hollywood sign. So that mountain you're looking at, it would be coming in from behind. So I don't know really what you'd get. You'd actually be coming up from the side and behind the sign. What people really want is they want to get closer to the front of the sign. And frankly, those are neighborhoods. I don't know how you're going to solve that problem.
It's not going to work, huh?
No, I don't think so.
And this won't solve it?
Not for $30 million, no.
All right.
Now, video killed the radio star, but what killed FM? Well, apparently it's Norway. The country became the first in the world to shut down FM radio entirely. It's done so throughout 2017 in stages, and now they're done for good with FM, replaced by digital radio that offers more channels, more functions, and better sound quality at an eighth of the cost of maintaining FM. People have complained about the cost of buying new radios for older cars. Listenership has dropped, and most cars are still not equipped for digital. Not to fear, this only applies to national stations, and local radio can still broadcast in FM. Norway won't be alone for long. Switzerland, Denmark, and the UK are set to follow. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess long term it's a big deal. It's like it's a big whoop in Norway, but it isn't even for all stations, just the national ones. So it's still in bits and pieces, but it's coming and it's happening, and it had an impact. they said that the national public radio viewership dropped 20% over the year. So, you know, people have to adjust. There's a lot of buying to do of new product and things like that and retrofitting cars. So it's going to have an impact. It's not automatic and easy, but, you know, long term, it's going to happen all over the world. And that will roil the radio ship, which is still a really big market.
9 European news agencies are pushing to get internet giants like Google, Facebook, Twitter, and others to pay copyright for news content they use. Good luck. At the same time, the EU is debating a directive to pay a fee for the news they link to in any way. And this is a quote, "Facebook has become the biggest media in the world," the agency said in a plea published in the French daily Le Monde. Yet neither Facebook nor Google have a newsroom. They do not have journalists in Syria risking their lives, nor a bureau in Zimbabwe investigating Mugabe's departure, nor editors to check and verify information sent in by reporters on the ground, end quote. Facebook's profits tripled to $10 billion. News is the number two reason people log onto the site. Big deal or big whoop?
The number one reason is, I guess, to post happy birthday notices?
Pretty much, yes.
Yeah. I think it's a very big deal if it happens. This is fascinating. They are profiting massively from linking people to news stories. And if there's a way to monetize that so the actual people creating the content that is proving so valuable to them can make more money and then get a piece of that pie, I'm all for it.
Yeah, I have a feeling what will happen. I mean, that's kind of like breaking the internet, right? So what they'll do is they'll just say, no, you can't post copywritten content. Sorry.
But that will massively hurt their business.
Maybe.
I think they'll come to some compromise and say, and have to recognize, yeah, we're making $10 billion this year, and a lot of it's due to the news companies, and we can see where it's coming from and where it's going, and we can monetize that and say, all right, you get a piece of this. You know, your content is proving useful to us, and we're going to recognize that through taking this step. Whether they do it willingly or it becomes regulated, I don't think that'll break the internet. They're just saying, you know, you reach a certain size and level, and you reach a certain level of income, and you're connecting these people to this. All right. So it won't affect me linking to a New York Times article, but it will affect Facebook.
Well, you know, they tried this in Spain where they had Google News was, you know, they wanted to charge Google News to link to different outlets. And Google said, you know what? Actually, no Google News for Spain.
It has to be systemic and everyone everywhere, you know. You can't do it piecemeal, for sure.
Yeah, and everybody was up in arms. So they put, you know, the country said, okay, fine. You know, we won't do that.
Well, it's very hard to make happen, and they're big gorillas, and it's going to be hard to make it go. And you can't just focus on Facebook and not do Google and Twitter too. So it's going to be difficult. It's not an easy fix. They haven't spelled out how they want it to work, but it's a good idea.
I think we're going to have to disagree on that one. Now, video gamers would rather switch than fight. That's the takeaway for Nintendo's new gaming system, dubbed Nintendo Switch. The gimmick? You can hook it up to your TV and you can take the portable screen included with you anywhere so you never have to leave your gaming behind. It's worked, with Nintendo revising its sale estimates up again and again, despite bottlenecks in production. After Black Friday, they say the system has sold 10 million units worldwide and is on pace to hit 16 million units for the first full year in release. That would be on par with first year sales for the original Wii and exceed sales of the Wii U. Not hard to do, actually, during its entire 5-year lifespan. Big deal or big whoop?
Yeah, well, it's a big deal. Like you say, Wii U was a big flop, and now they've come roaring back. Their game sales are really strong. A good metric. If you have a console system for a game that's unique to your system, or, you know, that version for your system, is to sell like 20%. If like 20% of the people who own your console own a game, that means it's a big hit. They've got 3 titles that are owned by 50% of their console owners, and that's a reflection of their passion for the game, not like just limited titles available. So it's a really good sign that they're making games that are really popular with their users. The sales are double already what Wii U was for its entire lifetime. So it's Nintendo's back on track. I think it's a big deal.
Professional sports is big business, but you already knew that.
What?
Yeah, you already knew that. In 2018, it's going to get even bigger, even as viewership gets splintered by TV and digital and streaming rights. A report by PricewaterhouseCoopers says media rights for North American sports will hit $20 billion in 2018, outstripping ticket sales, which are projected to hit $19 billion. The money doesn't stop there. Sponsorship will hit $17.6 billion, and merchandise will hit $14.5 billion. That brings the estimated haul in 2018 to $71 billion. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I frankly, if you'd asked me, I would have assumed media was already bigger than ticket sales.
Yes, yeah, so,
I'm kind
so
of shocked that it wasn't. So, wow. That's how many people go to sports events, I guess. But you look at the whole pie, it's really big. Media is just going to get bigger. So, yeah, it's a very big deal.
Bookstore sales in North America fell in October compared to the same month 1 year earlier. That's the third month in a row this has been true, and it comes amidst an overall increase in retail sales. Year-to-date, bookstore sales are down 2.9%, while retail sales overall are up 3.9%. I have no idea what I just said. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, bookstore sales are down, but people overall are buying more stuff. So if everything was slumping, you'd say, well, okay, books are just reflecting what's going on in the economy. But in fact, retail sales are up almost 4% overall, but in books, they're down 3%. So that's a big, bad spread.
Okay, I get it.
We are sort of comparing apples to apples because we're looking at bookstore sales in North America this month of October compared to 1 year earlier. And it's the third month in a row we've seen a decline. But you always have to keep in mind with books that the biggest piece of the puzzle is invisible. It's a black hole, and that's Amazon. They're the number one bookseller. They dominate in ebook sales, and none of that is reflected in these figures. That doesn't make for good news for the bookstores. It doesn't help them at all. But as far as overall book sales, we still don't quite know. Maybe they're exploding on Amazon. Maybe they're exploding in digital, but it ain't good news. That's for sure. And all you see lately in the news story, look, they're starting new independent bookstores are on the rise. They keep wanting to say that, and it's just not true. They're like, this independent bookstore, they're raising money so that they can pay off expenses and stay open. It's like, it's lovely that people support them. This one bookstore that Publishers Weekly was talking about, but that ain't a sign of a really flourishing business.
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced its newest members, and New Jersey rockers Bon Jovi are among them. It's about effing time, sort of, said John Bon Jovi, whose group also won the fan vote, by the way. Other new members include Nina Simone, The Cars, Dire Straits, The Moody Blues, and Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We've already weighed in on all these people and the longer list and who should make it and not. So just say congratulations to everybody. We're glad for them. I'm especially excited for Sister Rosetta Tharpe and Nina Simone.
Two of the people who are not actually rock musicians, but okay. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And basically, this is how this week's story will affect you. When you go to Disneyland and when you go to Disney World, you will now be able to see Marvel. Well, actually, Marvel characters have always been there, but X-Men characters.
Yeah, that's true. Yes.
And Avatar, I guess, has always been there. Well, now is there. You know what? I don't know. Simpsons characters, maybe. I don't know how it's going to affect you. Okay.
Well, let's focus on the fact that Disney is buying big assets from 21st Century Fox. They're basically buying the film and TV studios. They're buying a lot of cable channels like National Geographic and FX. They're buying 22 regional sports networks. And they're buying international networks like Star India. They're also gaining Fox's 30% stake in Hulu. So Disney will now own 60% of Hulu. They're getting a significant piece of Roku. They're getting Fox's 39% stake in Sky, which blows my mind.
Like, what's the point? I mean, because didn't they want to buy 100% of Sky?
They did. So now Disney will own a piece of Sky, and they'll want 100% of it. Something that Fox was fighting for a long time to do, but Sky is part of an entertainment universe, which is what Disney has, whereas Fox is holding on to sports and news. They're keeping the Fox News Channel, they're keeping Fox Sports Network, and a lot of others, which makes it confusing to me why they sold off regional sports networks to Disney. So there's a lot to take in here, but the big overall thing is two of the biggest studios in the world have just merged, and so like 30%, 40% of the entire world TV movie market is from one studio.
Yeah, it's 40%. And it's, I don't know, there are certain calls in Congress to maybe have some hearings about whether this kind of broaches antitrust. I don't see it broaching antitrust because there's still plenty of competition out there, but it's certainly, it's all about scale, really.
Well, 40% of the world market, how does that come up with an antitrust issue?
Well, because it's still not a majority.
Well, it's a huge chunk of it. It doesn't have to be 51% to be antitrust. You know, that's not the ruling on antitrust. 40% is already so massively big, almost no one can say no to you. So if I was in charge, this wouldn't go through. The AT&T Time Warner deal wouldn't go through. Lots of these massive conglomerations would not go through because it's certainly not good for consumers. But it's probably, you know, and Trump has already given his blessing of approval to it. He says it's going to be great for jobs, by which I guess it means people will lose them.
Yes, I don't understand this. I mean, let's put it this way. Iger specifically said there will be $2 billion worth of synergies.
That's all $3 billion.
Okay, well, either way, $2 billion, $3 billion. Let me translate that for you. People will lose their jobs, probably mostly at 20th Century Fox. Okay, right. That's what's going to happen.
The marketing departments, the HR departments, the accounting departments, all the backroom people. There's a lot of mid-level executives. Some of them, too, will lose their jobs, though less so. So, yeah, that's where you save money. You've got they both have all these different departments set up all over the world, and now they only need one instead of two. So some people will keep their job, but most will lose them.
Yes. Now, for Fox, there were really three things driving this deal. First was fear. You had, you know, Rupert Murdoch, who I saw recently, earlier this year, he's pretty spry, okay? But still, he's 87, 88 years old, okay? That he, you know, he's amazing for 88 that he's still running around the way he is. But I think everybody looks now I'm completely blank, Sumner Redstone, and they kind of say, well, we don't want another company in a situation like that where there's no succession plan, at least with Rupert Murdoch and the Murdochs, there was a succession plan, sort of, and we'll get to that in
now he says, forget it, I'm just selling it off, and sorry, James, good luck.
Right. So, first of all, the fear for Murdoch was that his company did not grow big enough and scale big enough in the world of digital on-demand consumption of TV and movies, that he didn't do what most companies, well, Warner Brothers and Disney did specifically, which is studios are now IP management companies. They manage intellectual property. And you really see that with Disney. Disney figured it out. They figured it out early. And they now own all of this intellectual property that they can monetize across different channels, whether it's the theme parks, whether it's television, whether it's movies, whether it's merchandise. They figured it out. So there was that fear. So then there was the opportunity. Okay, they kind of looked at cable subscribership kind of going down, these big packages going down, everybody was going a la carte, and we've talked about cable cutting. There was looking across that spectrum, they kind of said, you know what, our properties right now at 20th Century Fox Film are probably, you know, the most they will ever be, at least in our lifetime, so let's sell. And then, as you mentioned, Michael, there's that whole dynasty problem. Guess what doesn't happen now? As you say, Lachlan Murdoch will stay with, whatever becomes of 21st Century Fox.
Right, because news and sports is his area. That's his expertise. So he's in charge, and that's what they kept. They kept Fox News and Fox Sports. So that's his domain. James Murdoch was in charge of all the stuff that just got sold to Disney.
Right, and so now there's some discussion about whether, you know, Iger, who's staying now through 2021, as we kind of had reported last week, whether James goes over there and kind of becomes trained to take over once Iger leaves.
Well, that may be Murdoch wishful thinking, or maybe it'll happen. That'll be amazing if it does. That'll be sort of like Pixar coming in and being bought up by Disney, and then Pixar taking over the whole animation department. So if that happens, that'll be genius. But I'm guessing more likely he doesn't get a job at all with Disney. Or, you know, he moves on to something else, or he does get a job there and fades away, but gets a job, takes over it. That would be amazing.
Yeah. We'll mean, the unspoken fourth right here that nobody's really kind of, well, Michael Wolff pointed it out. And that is the largest shareholder outside the Murdochs in 21st Century Fox is a Saudi prince. One of the Saudi princes that is now imprisoned, by the Saudi government. Granted, it's in a 4-star hotel, but still, if that particular, if the government comes in and takes all of his assets and
they don't know what they might do to the company. Yeah,
correct. Because for the Murdochs, it's always been about control. If all of a sudden Saudi Arabia or the Saudi prince starts shedding shares of 21st Century Fox, it might fall into the hands of somebody who has, you know, could gain control of the company. And they might need to buy back those shares themselves. So they need cash. Guess what they're getting from this deal? Cash.
And of course, they're splitting up the company. So some of those shares probably will transfer to one or the other. Or I don't know how it works. That's all. It depends on how they've been structured. But yes, they're keeping Fox News and Fox Sports. Fox News is the most watched basic cable network in 2017. It's still number one. It still gets lots of people and churns out lots of money for Fox, despite losing their top star with Bill O'Reilly and Megyn Kelly, their biggest rising star. So they're still making money. We'll have to see how that ends up 5 years from now, but they're still in good shape.
Yeah, and of course, we mentioned in a couple weeks ago that we wondered whether 20th Century Fox would sell the lot that it's on in Century City. It is, you want to talk about prime real estate, it's 53 acres in the dead center of Los Angeles. I mean, it
good
is,
Lord.
It's worth billions. I wouldn't doubt that it's worth $62 billion on its own.
Yeah, and they kept it. I mean, like, why didn't Disney want it? And the idea was that, well, it's just so damn valuable and that everybody wants studio space and it's so perfectly situated that you'd just be a fool to give it up.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been the studio. It's in between Sony and MGM and Paramount and Santa Monica. It's really just a perfect location. And you know what? It would have a lot more acreage if, you know, wasn't for Cleopatra in 1961. That film cost so much money that the folks running Fox had to sell their backlot to, I can't remember, Alcoa was one of them, the, you know, American Aluminum Company or Aluminum Company of America. And
right.
They then built Century City on it. So, you know, they had to sell, I think it was like 1.2 million, I can't remember how many acres, but that's kind of Los Angeles lore.
Oh, absolutely. So a lot of ramifications. The deal will probably go through, especially with the current U.S. government and whatever issues they'll have overseas. I'm sure they'll make it happen. It affects Hulu and how that company will be down the road. It affects all sorts of things, but the fallout is going to take years to shake out.
Yeah, and for Disney, it gets them a couple things. One, it gives them a library, right, so that they can have this streaming service with more than just Disney content. Okay, they buy back Marvel titles from, you know, all the X-Men and the Star Wars that they will now own, which they kind of own anyway, but the distribution rights were 20th Century Fox's, but now they will all be in-house. It also gives them more assets and more IP for their theme parks.
And one of the things that people keep saying is, oh, Disney had to do this so they could compete with Netflix. And I'm like, do they really feel like Netflix is about to punch them into the ground? I mean, Netflix is doing great. Disney's doing great. Are they really like, oh my God, we have to compete with Netflix? That just didn't make any sense to me.
No,
maybe I'm being silly, but it seems like they have a lot of different areas, a TV network, they have studios, they have theme parks, they have, you know, cruises, they have all sorts of areas, merchandise that Netflix doesn't have. They seem like a really good, strong, well-run business. Why would they be panicked or worried about Netflix or see them as their number one competitor?
Well, they're basically seeing them as a competitor in the streaming space. And the question is, will people switch over and buy a Netflix subscription and a Disney subscription if it's just Disney films? Or will they drop Netflix for Disney? And what Disney is saying is, we're going to remove 20th Century Fox films from Netflix. We're going to remove Disney films from Netflix. And we might license other content as well. And guess what? We'll also be in control of Hulu because Comcast can't control it because of certain stipulations in taking over NBC, which is the other majority owner of Hulu. And so, you know, the other thing that they're getting with this is leverage, frankly, with whether it's the Writers Guild, who's very upset about this.
Of course, one less big player. It's bad for everybody who's a freelancer.
Or cable providers who want to charge ABC or ESPN for carriage. And frankly, if you're a sports team, you got to be a little concerned about this because you were able to negotiate with both ESPN and the Fox Networks and ABC. And now,
well, Fox Networks is still separate, remember?
Well, the Fox Sports Networks, sorry.
Yeah, but the regional networks are now controlled by ABC. I don't understand why, if you're in sports, why they sold off the regional networks to Disney, but who knows?
Yeah, I have no idea either. That makes no sense to me. I was surprised they didn't keep that.
Yeah. But who knows? Oh, well, the deal will go through. We'll be dealing with it for years. Fox is dead. Long live Fox.
Oh, well, you know, since we're talking about, you know, dead things or dead companies, although Fox isn't a dead company, it's just now it's been consumed. but somebody who won't be consuming anything anymore. I don't know. This is a horrible transition, but what I'm trying to say is Zhang Yun of K-pop Shin E died at the age of 27.
Yes, a very sad story, a possible suicide. That's what it sounds like from early reports out of Korea. A big pop star. His group formed in 2008. They've been big ever since. His sister got concerned for him, called the police, and they found him unconscious, and he never recovered. So very sad news in the pop music world of Korea. And in the U.S., we also lost a great singer, Keely Smith.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, she's a great jazz singer and the wife of Louis Prima, who was also a great jazz singer and performer. She's a great gal. She was she died at 87, I think. 89 years old. And she had a great long career. She was a Grammy-winning hepcat, was how I described her. Her signature tune was That Old Black Magic. It was an early hit for her and Louis. She sung it at JFK's inaugural. Kermit the Frog sang it wearing a wig to look like Keely Smith, who had distinctive black hair. She performed at the Grammys in 2008, decades later, with Kid Rock. She was in a Las Vegas fixture and one of the few people, really, to record a duet in the studio with Frank Sinatra until the end of his career. Early on in the mid and the capital years, she did a couple songs with Frank. That's how much he liked her. He really didn't record studio duets with a lot of people. So that was really unusual at the time. It was sort of a trivia answer that at the end of his life, he did the duets albums and, you know, sang with a lot of people. But a very cool, fun jazz singer, great long career, just a cool, cool figure. And, you know, she's gone at 89.
And there was a play called Louis and Keely. It was a musical. It was really good.
Oh, cool. I'm sorry. I never saw it.
It was called Louis and Keely Live at the Sahara. And it was, I think John Wells took it over. I think it was John Wells. It was really, I saw it like in some black box theater, and then it slowly made it bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm. Well, gosh, Berlin, I guess we have to wish you a happy new year, Merry Christmas, because, you know, we're not going to be back for 2 weeks, are we?
No, we're not. Yes, and happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah. I don't know what other holidays.
Happy Kwanzaa, happy winter solstice.
Yes, to all of our listeners. So thank you for listening this entire year and every week. You know, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. That way you won't miss an episode. So please do subscribe to us, rate, review the show. It does help us out when you do. You can find those links on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's KeelySmithLives.com.
Oh, okay. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to theHuffingtonPost.com? Or you can head over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, do not forget to check out bookfilter.com if you want to know what books you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next year, play nice.
And oh my God, that next episode is going to be so long.
Why? Because it's 2 weeks.
So much news, sexual harassment, box office. Oh my God, it's going to be 2 hours.